That was wonderful. Thank you.
How many of you are blamers? How many of you, when something goes wrong, the first thing you want to know is whose fault it is? Hi, my name is Brene. I am a blamer. Let me just tell you this quick story. So this is a couple years ago when I first realized the magnitude to which I blame. I'm in my house. I have on white slacks and a pink sweater set, and I'm drinking a cup of coffee in my kitchen. It's a full cup of coffee. I drop it on the tile floor. It goes into a million pieces, splashes up all over me. And the first, I mean, a millisecond after it hit the floor, right out of my mouth is this: "Damn you, Steve." Who is my husband? Because let me tell you how fast this works for me. So Steve plays water polo with a group of friends. And the night before, he went to go play water polo. And I said, hey, make sure you come back at 10, because, you know, I can never fall asleep into your home. And he got back like at 10:30. And so I went to bed a little bit later than I thought. Ergo, my second cup of coffee that I probably would not be having had he come home when we discussed. Therefore, and so the rest of that story is I'm cleaning up the kitchen. Steve calls, caller ID. I'm like, hey. He's like, hey, what's going on, babe? What's going on? So I'll tell you exactly what's going on. I'm cleaning up the coffee that spilled all, like dial tone. Because he knows. How many of you go to that place when something bad happens, the first thing you want to know is whose fault is it? I'd rather it be my fault than no one's fault. Because why? Why? Because it gives us some semblance of control. But here, if you enjoy blaming, this is where you should stick your fingers in your ear and do the no thing, because I'm getting ready to ruin it for you. Because here's what we know from the research. Blame is simply the discharging of discomfort and pain. It has an inverse relationship with accountability. Accountability, by definition, is a vulnerable process. It means me calling you and saying, hey, my feelings were really hurt about this, and talking. It's not blaming. Blaming is simply a way that we discharge anger. People who blame a lot seldom have the tenacity and grit to actually hold people accountable, because we expend all of our energy raging for 15 seconds and figuring out whose fault something is. And blaming is very corrosive in relationships, and it's one of the reasons we miss our opportunities for empathy. Because when something happens and we're hearing a story, we're not really listening. We're in the place where I was, making the connections as quickly as we can about whose fault something was.
Isn't that the funniest video? Just damn you, Steve. Well, the thing is, it's true. Did you guys see? I saw myself in that. I mean, I've done it. Blamed. It just seems to happen. And I think it's sort of a very telling feature of our culture, that we try so hard to be right, to be perfect, to do it right, to be right, to say things right. We want to be perfect, and we think we're supposed to be. What if we're not perfect? You know, oh my gosh, then we risk whatever, disappointment, rejection, you know, not being loved. All of those things are at risk if we're not perfect. And so if, like, it's going to happen because we're not perfect, if something happens like that, we spill something, we can't be us. Gonna have to shift the blame someplace else. You know, we don't have to be that way, though. This, if we can recognize, this is pretty universal. If we can recognize that some of these words that we're going to be talking about, we've already talked about last week too, blame and shame and vulnerability, all of those things are sort of wrapped up with with maybe an erroneous way of looking at how we're to be moving through life, perhaps. We are considering this month doing things daring greatly, doing things differently by daring greatly. Daring Greatly is the book that we started looking at last week by Brené Brown. It was her voice on the video. And it is a way, if we can get a grip on not being perfect, if we can get a sense of something deeper, what we call our Christ selves, if we can begin to tap into that and refer to that, remember that, as opposed to some of these old habits and these old ways of doing things, we're going to have much happier lives, much more successful lives, much more fulfilled lives. And as we said last week, this is completely in line with why we come to church. We come to church because here in Unity we teach that Jesus came to teach us the way to let our Christ light shine. Jesus came to tell us that you can do greater things too, that we have within us a power that is bigger than we think it is. And it behooves us then to get past the blaming and the shaming and come to that Christ self. And so this month, we're looking at ways that we can do that with Brené Brown's help. Last week, just a real quick review, we are looking at her book, Daring Greatly. We started out, you know, we just sort of... I think I gave you too much information, too much detail last week, but she is a woman who left a middle management job and went back to school because she wanted to help people. Got a bachelor's in social work and then a master's in social work, and toward the end of that program realized that she wants to help people, but it's messy, you know, with the interactions and stuff. And so in that process then had discovered that she really likes understanding better relationships, all, you know, how humans interact and all that sort of thing. So she went into research, and shame and empathy are the main features, I guess, of what she studied, embraced. She got her doctorate, you know, so she's really good at naming shame and blame, and we're gonna look at that more completely. She said that she told us about other books that she had written. One was something about the gifts of imperfection. And in writing that and then finishing it and realizing that she herself was not doing what she was writing about, that of the 10 gifts of imperfection, she had only really kind of done 2 of them. She had what she called a breakdown / cross that out, spiritual awakening. So it was in the going deeper and trying to understand then how we can be better, be more, that she ended up doing lots more research, lots more introspection, and interviewing people to come with this book, Daring Greatly. She talked about 2 in review. We talked just briefly about, or now briefly, scarcity was one of the things that we touched on last week. The whole idea of us being in such a cultural mindset of not enough, you know, from the time we wake up to didn't get enough sleep, just throughout the whole day, not enough, we want more, not enough, not enough, not enough. And the opposite of that is not abundance, but it is enough. And so that was one of the key points that we talked about. She says that we want to live in a state of wholeheartedness. Wholeheartedness, and I would call that blueprint of the Christ self in Unity terms. And she also talked about vulnerability myths. One of the biggest ones is that being vulnerable is a weakness. No, it's not. It actually takes great courage to be vulnerable. Think about it yourself. Now, the last time maybe you had an opportunity to stand up and say what you believe versus not saying it, or when you're vulnerable, it takes courage, great courage. It isn't oversharing. That was another thing that I think when I think of being vulnerable, sometimes, You feel like it's kind of like Facebook, where you're going to tell everybody what you had for lunch and, you know, where you're going, you know, all that. It isn't that either. It is not oversharing. It is a process of learning who's trustworthy, who is in connection with you to the point where you feel like you can share, you can be vulnerable. She says that vulnerability is the catalyst for wholeheartedness. For wholeness, I think I would say. So she really is pushing this idea that we want and we need to be vulnerable. Scary, isn't it? It is. It is. So then the next thing, the major thing she talks about is shame. She has a definition of shame. And actually, it's a component, she said, of scarcity. But the definition, her definition of shame is the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing that we are flawed and therefore unworthy of love and belonging. Does that resonate? It did for me. It did for me. There's a difference between shame and guilt. Guilt is when you say, I did something bad. I dropped the cup. Shame is, I'm a bad person. I am so stupid. The difference between, she goes to great lengths actually in the book to emphasize that guilt can be a great motivator. Guilt is a positive thing because it causes us to look at what we did, not what we are, and make efforts to do better. Shame, on the other hand, is piling on blame for being such unworthy, bad people. Shame is not positive, not beneficial in any way, shape, or form. A quote that she says, a sense of worthiness inspires us to be vulnerable, to share openly, and persevere. Shame keeps us small, resentful, and afraid. I'll tell you what, I was reading this book and it was just like, oh, yes, oh, yes. It makes me want to read the whole thing to you, but that is just boring, so I won't do that. But I just love what she says. That's when we feel worthy. Think about it. When you feel worthy, when you feel good about yourself, you're much more open. You're willing to share openly, and you're willing to try it again. I can remember a time when my now ex-husband was complaining about a meal. We were trying to teach the boys some basic cooking, you know, just so that they could. And we did that. We did a whole, you know, family cleaning day, so they knew how to clean. They did their own laundry. We did. They hated us for it, but we did it. So my son had made this spaghetti dinner, and so the spaghetti was a little chewy, you know. But it tasted, the sauce was fine. It was jarred sauce. I mean, it wasn't like it was a real hard meal, but my ex-husband made some comment. I don't even remember exactly what it was, and he took the dish over to the sink. I was livid, just livid. Here he goes out. He tries to do something, and then my ex has to make a shaming comment about how bad the meal was. I don't think so. So... we didn't have that happen again. but we do that. We do that as people. We belittle, we make fun of, and it's a lot of that kind of stuff. You know, I think we're trying to look better ourselves, or maybe we even a misguided notion of trying to help the other person, but we're not. We're hurting. If we're shaming somebody, we're hurting them. That is not a cool thing to do. She has something called the shame 1-2-3s. These were good. And I love this. She says, "Why? What is shame and why is it so hard to talk about it?" In parentheses under that, she says, "If you're pretty sure that shame doesn't apply to you, keep reading. I'll clear that up in the next couple of pages." Indeed. Number one, we all have it. Shame is universal and one of the most primitive human emotions that we experience. The only people who don't experience shame lack the capacity for empathy and human connection. Here's your choice. Fess up to experiencing shame or admit that you're a sociopath. Quick note, this is the only time that shame seems like a good option. So shame is universal. That's number one. Number two, we're all afraid to talk about shame. Number three, the less we talk about shame, the more control it has over our lives. Very true. Remember a time perhaps when you did feel shame. It is pain, isn't it? It's real pain. It's not physical, like somebody has cut your arm off or anything, but it is real. It is real emotional pain. There are some examples. She found 12 shame categories that she, in her interviews, her research had found. Their appearance and body image, big one. Money and work, motherhood/fatherhood, family, parenting, mental and physical health, addiction, sex, aging, religion, surviving trauma, being stereotyped or labeled. All of those are categories of shame. And she said, some of the responses, I'm not going to read all of them, but I think some of these are just so telling. Because when we look, when we're willing to share what the shame is, you might hear something like this. Shame is getting laid off and having to tell my pregnant wife. Shame is hiding the fact that I'm in recovery. Shame is raging at my kids. Shame is my boss calling me an idiot in front of my client. Shame is my DUI. Shame is flunking out of school twice, and many more. When we think about ourselves and what has happened in our lives that made us feel that emotion of shame, it's universal. We all have our own variations of it. It is real pain. It is. So what do we do? So we all have this human thing that we do called shame. Well, then she goes on to describe something called shame resilience. She said, not shame resistance, because resistance is futile, but resilience. What do we do when shame hits? This, I think, is interesting. She says that shame resilience requires cognition or thinking. I did series of classes when I was still in Jeff City. There's a book called Emotional Intelligence by Daniel Goleman that came out, I think, in the mid-90s, and I loved that book. In that book, I learned that the brain has, they call it the limbic system. It is that primitive brain. I think it's called the amygdala. And when something fearful triggers us, we go into that primitive, the first thing is we go into the primitive brain, the fight, flight, or freeze mode. And it hijacks the brain. When you're in that, it's either that or then what you want often is the frontal cortex. That's the thinking part, the reasoning part. But sometimes when this something triggers the shame, we go into that fight or flight. It triggers that limbic thing. So shame resilience first is going to call us to think, to do everything we can to switch the control from that primitive brain to the frontal cortex. Well, I'll give you a way that she recommends doing that. There are elements of shame resilience, and I'm going to use an example that she gave in here of something that happened to her as I go through each of these four elements. The first one is recognizing shame and understanding its triggers. She tells a story in here about her reluctance, I guess, if you will, to become big, you know, through all of this work that she's doing, because then you're out in front of everyone, the internet, and the haters, you know, the ones who are going to make very critical remarks are out there, and they came, and she was getting remarks and stuff. She got one particular email that must have been especially nasty. She got the email. He was talking about how bad a person she was and how dare she, you know, blah, 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 blah. She formed a response that she was going to send, excuse me, to her husband, used some profanity in what she was writing to her husband, let it be known what she thought of this fellow, and I can't say any of this from here. So, and instead of hitting forward, she hit reply. And it talks about how immediately she went, no, because that reply went to the guy. Talked about that pain. She was like, she was immediately flooded with shame. He was right. I have no business trying to teach this stuff. Look at what I've just done. I've, you know, just all of this stuff that just flooded her in that moment. A tip that she gives for when you're in that, I mean, she was completely hijacked by that primitive brain. She was just, oh my God, what have I done? And the tip is that when you're in it, she says, just say the word pain, 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 over and over again, and she says surprisingly it works, because it will give the cortex control again, because you're just saying pain, which is what you're experiencing. So then once your brain gets, okay, she's experiencing pain, now I can think again, then it helps you move on then to the second. So that first one, recognizing shame and understanding its triggers, she understood very clearly what had happened and what triggered her. The second one is practice critical awareness. So then she thought about, had a chance once she got control back up here in her brain, she thought about what had happened. Does this really mean? No, it doesn't really mean I'm a terrible person. And she was able to kind of look at some of those things, but she's still feeling pretty bad about what has happened, which took us to the third thing, which is reaching out. So she called her husband, Steve, and talked to him, and she also called her best friend. And she said that they both treated her with empathy and support. Oh, I've done that, you know, I've done things where I've sent something I didn't mean to and then felt terrible. Neither of them, of course they wouldn't, because they love her, and there's a reason why she trusts them. They were both very supportive. Her husband, I think, was supportive. Her friend, before the conversation was over, got her laughing. So she was in a better place. So reaching out is the third step. The fourth is speaking shame. So then what she did was she answered, of course, then the guy who received the second email, or get her response, I knew it, I knew you were a terrible, you know, he responded again. She sent an email to him to say, I'm, she apologized for her reaction, her profanity. She said she set boundaries, she, you know, said something about what she believed, set boundaries, and she'd never heard from the guy again. She was able to address, I did this, I was wrong, I wish I hadn't done that, I apologize for the profanity I've used. Speak your shame. So she faced him, told him, I shouldn't have done that. Shame resilience. Something that was hugely surprising to me was gender. And she said that she started out with just interviewing women because she wanted to understand the nuances of being a woman and shame and so forth. And she describes an experience of when a man comes up to her after one of her lectures. Well, actually, he and his wife come up. The wife had bought several books of Brené's, and she signed them. And then the husband turned to the wife and said, "You go ahead, I'll be with you in just a minute." And then he turned back to Brené and began to talk. And what he said was that he felt tremendous. He asked her if she had had any interviews with men, and she said, "No, I haven't." And he said, "Well, that figures," or something like that. She said, "What do you mean?" You know. Well, then they had this conversation, and he opened the door for her to begin to consider shame from both gender perspectives. It is amazing. I won't tell you all of it, but some of it for women. Women, look perfect, do perfect, be perfect. Anything less than that is shaming. Their experiences of shame, being judged by other mothers. Those were the two biggest ones, the appearance and then the whole thing about motherhood. Another aspect of all that is that we're supposed to make it look natural or easy. You know, so we're supposed to... I have seen things from home ec classes from the 50s where the wife is supposed to stop what she's doing and make sure that she puts on fresh makeup and has her dress nice and everything when her husband comes home from work. You know? Really? I'm way too much feminist for that. But the thing is, if you know, there was a whole lot of shaming that was going on around the time, you know, the 50s, 60s, about what a good wife, a good woman was supposed to be. So not only are you expected to be able to be perfect, to be slim, be attractive, have a clean house, your clean's important, all of that, and you're supposed to make it look like it's easy. Yeah. Men, oh, one thing before I go there, when during the 70s there was a huge, huge outpouring of feminism, and lots of gains were made for equal rights and all that, for women and all of that, and you might think that, well, it's not so bad anymore, right? Not so much. She talks about the responses that she got. She said, "These mean-spirited people." This is very recently. This is just, you know, in the last year or so. Comments. How can she talk about worthiness when she clearly needs to lose 15 pounds? I feel sorry for her children. Good mothers don't fall apart. Another comment. Less research, more Botox. If I look like Brené Brown, I'd embrace imperfection too. Yes. She said, they went after my appearance and my mothering. The two weakest spots, the two things that are most. So, you know, it's still alive and well. And it's not just us girls. Men, this really surprised me. And I want to say to the men, I had no idea. I had no idea. Shame is failure. It says, basically, men live under the pressure of one unrelenting message. Do not be perceived as weak. Do you remember the commercials not that long ago where it shows, I think it was a beer commercial or something, and it shows guys getting kind of like knocked down or, you know, things that you know had to hurt, physically hurt, and yet they'd bounce right back up and they said, "I'm good." Do you remember those? Yeah. Men are not ever supposed to show that they're weak. Ever. And then what I was more surprised about was with women, if we have a male in our lives, a spouse, my son and I are extremely close. If we have men in our lives, my experience is they're very supportive of us. Men that were interviewed by Brené Brown were in kind of a double bind, because not only does society say that they're not supposed to ever be weak, but then they feel like the wives, the women in their lives, don't really want to know if they're not strong. It's, remember that movie, I think it was Jack Nicholson says, "You can't take the truth," or something like that. It's kind of like that. It was a story about a guy who lost his job, and he, for 6 months, would dress and go someplace to have coffee and look for work, and he didn't tell his wife that he had lost his job. And so in talking with her, "Well, why wouldn't you tell her?" And he said, "She really wouldn't want to know, because once I get the job and I'm working again, then I'll tell her that I was out of work. But for now, she needs to think that I'm the strong one." Men are in a place where, I mean, maybe it's not universal, but it sure gave the impression of the belief is, not only do I have to be strong, but I have to put that strong face on for everyone. I have to be strong for my wife. I have to be strong for my family. I can't show weakness or vulnerability to anyone. I thought I had it tough. So gender and shame is unbelievable. So what to do? Shame resilience. We want to practice. And how would we practice? Well, we would do that thing. If we catch ourselves feeling shame, then whatever you need to do to get the move, back up here again, pain, whatever you need to do to start thinking about, really look at it critically. Is this something that is, I'm a terrible person? Is this something I could maybe shift it from shame to guilt, perhaps? Practice that resilience. And I think this vulnerability is key. If we can, for ourselves, feel worthy first, and we here in Unity can be helped a lot by that, by knowing who and what we truly are. And so if we can remember and hold on to that worthiness, then it's a lot easier for us to be vulnerable. So practice being vulnerability is the path out of shame, and courage is the light. And I want to end this with an excerpt from The Velveteen Rabbit. "Real isn't how you are made," said the skin horse. "It's a thing that happens to you. When a child loves you for a long, long time, not just to play with, but really loves you, then you become real." "Does it hurt?" asked the rabbit. "Sometimes," said the skin horse, for he was always truthful. "When you are real, you don't mind being hurt." "Does it happen all at once, like being wound up or bit by bit?" "It doesn't happen all at once," said the skin horse. "You become. It takes a long time. That's why it doesn't often happen to people who break easily or have sharp edges or who have to be carefully kept. Generally, by the time you are real, most of your hair has been loved off, your eyes drop out, and you get loose in the joints and very shabby. But these things don't matter at all, because once you are real, you can't be ugly, except to people who don't understand." Let's take this opportunity to find that presence within ourselves again. If you haven't already, I invite you to gently close your outer eyes. Take a deep breath and release. And another breath. And out. We purposely, this morning, move our attention, our focus within. within to that place of peace, that beautiful, sacred, connecting place. For it is there that we go to when we need comfort, when we need strength. And as we consider daring greatly, as we consider being vulnerable, as we consider being real, we are grateful to have this sanctuary, this place, this internal dwelling place of peace and love. So right now we breathe. Let that feeling permeate our entire beings. Peace fills our hearts, our minds, reminds us of the truth of who and what we are. Beloved creations of the universe. This is truth. We rest in this truth. We rejoice in this truth. We are strengthened by this truth. Let us now take some time in silence to consider vulnerability, to consider the truth of who and what we are, to consider the lights that we have come here to be, and in the silence to feel and to be peace in the silence. And we are grateful. We are grateful for this relationship with the divine. Grateful for this awareness that is sort of like our mainstay, our foundation as we move through life. Grateful for this power that enables us to keep moving forward, to persevere, to be more and more our Christ selves. We are grateful for this community where we can come, be ourselves, be safe, and be loved. We practice loving. We practice being peace, being the light here. And so in peace and in love and in deep gratitude for all we have, let us now come together to repeat the words, to pray the words that our way shower, our master teacher taught us, the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, And forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not in temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen.